Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, barring ball games, where we might get moved to 7 p.m. Saturday or 3 p.m. on Sunday. Check your local listings. We do rebroadcast the program on 8 to Zen.fm at 3 p.m. Pacific time on Sundays. That's a given, a regular, that's locked in. And we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, and those are available 24/7. So no matter what happens on the radio station, you can get it at A to Zen.fm or at the archives page. And we certainly hope that you'll check out our guests. We link to their websites and we encourage you to check them out. They have information that could certainly assist and help you and help to transform your life and so forth. So a good program today. We're going to, it's rather interesting. I haven't read Homer's Odyssey, which isn't the subject of today's program, but the title of the book is called Odyssey, Victim to Victory. My guest is Jennifer Elizabeth Masters. And Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Richard. I'm excited to be here.
It's interesting that you chose that title as far as, and I believe it is Homer's Odyssey, is it not?
That's right.
Okay. I also found out that that's perfectly acceptable as well as legal, because apparently you cannot trademark or copyright a book title.
No, that's true.
Yeah,
you cannot.
So you can have as many, of course, I haven't read Ulysses either, so no great loss from that standpoint, although I've heard a lot of these. I'm classically literarily challenged, I guess is the word. I am still working after, I think, 15 years. I'm still working on getting through Stranger in a Strange Land. So if that tells you anything, just very busy. You have been very busy as well, and you have quite the story to tell as well. But you have gone through the ringer and back and have transformed your life into something that has created for you the opportunity to be a life coach, an inspiration to many other folks. And we want to certainly commend you on that transformation. You're a certified hypnotherapist, as well as a healer teacher, and you're also an ordained minister. Tell me a little bit about how that came about, because from what I'm understanding, and I might have said, forget God, he allowed all of this to happen to me. I'm going to go my own way. I'm not going to become a part of the disbursement of the message.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up God. My perception of how life works is that we have a divine plan that has been set in motion, and we can deviate slightly from that plan, you know, make some turns and twists along the way, but basically certain things are going to happen to us, and the reason for those certain experiences to evolve our soul. It's merely for us to come to a better understanding of who we are. God doesn't make these things happen. These are things that our soul has asked for.
Okay. And now, these are the kinds of conversations I get into with people where I say, then we need to come to an understanding. The paradox that I see between predestination and free will, because my understanding, as limited as it is, and I'm learning and I'm growing and I'm trying to understand more each day, is that on the one hand, you have the creator, the universal power that brought all of this into being and knows where it came from and where it's going to. Ergo, we really don't have any choice. At the same time, we hear about free will, and we can make choices, and we can think for ourselves and process and have logical thought and problem-solving skills and so on and so forth that can, as the phrase goes, Jennifer, the reason I am where I am today is because of the choices I made in the past. Where do I want to be tomorrow, and what are the choices I need to make today to get there, as opposed to doing it all unconscious. So can you share with us your perspective on that paradox between predestination and free will?
Well, predestination is a given. There is predestination. As I just explained, there's a certain path that we are going to take to get to our destination. And it isn't about the destination. It's about the day-to-day, moment-by-moment experiences. And this is where people get lost. It isn't, oh, I'm going to go to heaven, and so that's my sole goal. No, the moment-by-moment experience is where we're supposed to be focusing. Do we have free will? We have a certain amount of free will, so we can deviate slightly from the plan. We can marry more people than we were probably destined to marry, having more experiences along the way, sleep with a few more people than perhaps was on our divine plan. So there is a certain amount of free will. But ultimately, we are going to get to our destination.
Right. So from your experiences, the process of coming to a best case scenario of dealing with the various events along the way in on our path, do you believe that we chose those, say, like as on the same level as like a contract?
Well, yes, and here, because I'm a medium and a psychic, I've had experiences where I've been to this place called Bardo, which is where we are before our soul reincarnates. And we meet with our masters, guides, teachers, and also a lot of our loved ones that will be also incarnated in the same lifetime, and we come back with the same soul groups over and over again. And so all of these things, you know, there's a lot of planning that goes into our life path. So it's like standing on a high dive board with all of these light beings and teachers and loved ones around us. And we choose, okay, so do I choose those parents and I'll learn these things, or do I choose this family and learn these issues? So we have a choice as to which family we incarnate into, and whether we're male or female, and or as we're taking that high dive off the diving board into a body, I'll be male, I'll be female, I'll be male, I'll be female. Whoops, guess what? You're mixed up.
Mm. Well, and that's actually brought up an interesting issue for me in terms of dealing with folks who struggle with their own identity. I used to, and it wasn't, I was never dogmatic about it, but it just was kind of, I felt uneasy about people changing their appearance, let alone changing their gender. But I came to a point in my understanding and my awareness where I finally said, well, wait a minute. I have the opportunity in my life, because I'm comfortable in my skin for the most part, to be happy with the things that I do and the people I surround myself with. But then I began to meet people who were not happy in their skin the way it was. And I thought, but isn't that one of the things we talk about on this program? I mean, our U.S. Constitution, the preamble basically says that we have the right to life, liberty, but the pursuit of happiness. We can have life and liberty, but we can't have happiness, but we can pursue it. So I've always chuckled at the fact that, all right, you can never attain it. It's kind of like the carrot on the stick out on the string ahead of you, and you can never touch it, but you can always chase it. And yet that's what people are doing. They're trying to find happiness in their own lives. And if changing their gender and, you know, raising the eyebrows and the lips and whatever it is that they choose to do gives them that feeling of wholeness, you know, it's kind of like, well, then what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
And the fact that someone, even a child, and I've heard many stories about 3- and 4-year-old children being a female child in a male's body, or vice versa, a male child in a female body, and going to their parents and saying, Mommy, Daddy, when are you going to get me that operation to get me fixed?
Mm. Wow.
So at that point, it is not about sex. It is not about, well, I'm choosing to be gay. No, it's not. It's that you know, they're coming into a body. It was all mixed up. Very sad.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because I've gone through conversations with people. I'm not going to say debates, but conversations where I know what it was like to be bullied in school, in grade school and high school, because of my vision. And I've heard the stories of people who are gay and male or female, and the horrific punishment, if you will, that they take, whether it's verbally or physically, mentally and emotionally and so forth. And that people who don't understand and do not accept them say that it's a choice. They chose this. And I sit there going, are you kidding me? You mean to tell me that a human being would actually choose to be abused?
Well, I'm with you there. I'm right with you there. And I want to bring up a point. You know, I'm psychic and I channel, and my guides are telling me I need to talk about back in the 50s and even earlier, There were gay women, lesbian women and gay men, but they hid. You would see two spinsters, old ladies living together, never married. So it happened back then, but people were much more secretive about it. They didn't express themselves honestly. Can you imagine living that dual life? Must have been very painful.
Well, and it's interesting, even those who are attracted to the opposite sex end up doing the same thing in a relationship with someone, and they stay just because, oh, they justify it for whatever. Oh, I'm staying because of the kids, or again, whatever the reason being. And then when I hear about these individuals who are in these lives, these marriages, and then suddenly they shift out of that relationship and say, that wasn't me. I was hiding. I was whatever the case might be. And I just sit there going, and you were there for how long? 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And you're just now. And it's like, well, they just were able to summon up enough courage up to this point where they were able to make the break, make the transition.
Or some catalytic life event shows up, which helps spur them on to leaving, which is the case for me. Being molested as a child and then further victimized in three subsequent marriages, it took a catalytic event for me to be moved out and move up.
Yeah, when I was reading about your various marriages, I thought, well, you don't have anything on Zsa Zsa Gabor. She or Elizabeth Taylor, both of them, I believe, have passed. They were the epitome of changing partners pretty regularly. And you have to wonder then how happy were they
or any other
individual.
Line.
Yeah.
The reason that people are unhappy with their relationship is because they're not inherently happy with themselves. So if you're not totally in love with who you are and you wish you were different, or you're in a lot of pain about who you are and you can't accept yourself, then you're not going to be able to accept love from another. And typically what happens in that type of relationship, it's usually if you don't love yourself, you will be in an addictive relationship, whether there will be a sex addiction or codependency or alcoholism. All of those addictive issues come from a lack of self-love. Most people are not aware of that. So what will happen is you'll change yourself like a chameleon to be who that person wants you to be. And then 3, 4, 5 years into the relationship, you wake up and you go, what the heck? I can't be this person anymore. And then when you start to be your authentic self, your partner goes, who are you? It's like waking up.
Yeah.
And that often happens. And so typically that, you know, the 7-year itch or whatever you want to call it is because people are tired of faking it and they want to be who they truly are.
Yeah. I was watching a program the other night where the conversation between two people had to do with the fact that men always lie. Now, not lie in the sense of deceiving in terms of trying to get something for themselves, but they, and maybe that's the wrong word. Not the word lie is incorrect. It's they are afraid to reveal themselves to other people.
Well, that's the true meaning of intimacy.
For some men, and I'll be honest, there's still parts of me that I keep to myself. And actually, it's funny how I've justified it. You know the passage in the Bible that talks about how there were these certain events or these phrases or these words, these speeches, whatever that Jesus was giving, and Mary said nothing, but she pondered them in her heart. You remember that phrase?
Yes, yes.
That's what I do. I just keep them to myself, and I just ponder them. But they're about myself. And I'm wondering sometimes, Jennifer, if maybe it's okay, up to a point, it's okay to not. I mean, when I'm not talking necessarily here about saying, okay, it's okay to have secrets in a relationship. But is it necessary also then to reveal everything?
Well, you're making a very good point. The more trust there is in the relationship, the more apt you will be to uncover your true self with your partner. Will there be a point at which you'll reveal 100% of yourself? Probably not. I think it might be impossible to do so, but I do feel that the longer you're with someone where there is commitment and trust, and the more relaxed you become and the more authentic you become being your true self, the more apt you will be to allow that person in to really get to know that deep person that you are.
Right.
Than that high level.
Exactly. Now, you, having experienced the things that you have, let alone the two marriages...
And I'm going to correct you. It's four.
Oh, four. Well, it just doubled on us, didn't it? Kind of like the stock market.
Well, I have to comment on that. That, you know, being molested as a child, it made me the kind of person that mixed up sex and love. Mm-hmm. And then because I was victimized as a child, I sought victimization energetically. Not that I consciously wanted it, but that's the type of man that I attracted. And so it took me, I was very stubborn, and I learned very slowly, but I learned through my relationships, and that's what my book is all about, how to use your life experience, not as a negative, but how can you learn to be a better person? How can you understand yourself better? So no relationship is a mistake. It's all a lesson and a gift. Right. And that's the way I look at my whole life. None of it has been a mistake. I have become a much better person as a result of all of my experiences. And the tapestry of my life, I will say, is very colorful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said something just a moment ago that I have to, share my observations and get your input on it. You said so easily, so rhythmically, just in the course of your comments there, that you were molested as a child. I mean, there was no catch. There was no pause. It was as if, yeah, I woke up this morning and I had a cup of coffee and some eggs and hash browns, and then I went to work as casually as that. How long has it taken you to get to that point where, can I use the phrase, you're comfortable sharing that?
Absolutely. Interesting. I knew it happened, but it was in my 30s that all of a sudden it was like this volcano inside of me that was just erupting, and I could no longer keep it in. So that's when I talked to all my family. You know, I talked to my mother about it. And so I was in my mid-30s, and it took me probably almost 20 years. Not quite 20, but I mean, I did a lot of work on it. And if you read my book, you'll understand the fact that I was molested was a gift. I wouldn't be who I am today. I wouldn't be able to help other people that were molested or abused. I wouldn't be able to help people that had such low self-esteem and lack of confidence. Because I've experienced it, because I overcame it, the negativity and the illness, I also healed fibromyalgia within myself and Epstein-Barr syndrome. I was a very sick person, and it was all from the negativity and, you know, the self-perception. I caused the illness in my own body. And we often do that with cancer. A lot of people don't recognize that they create their own disease. It's from their thoughts, how they feel about themselves. So it doesn't define me. It's part of me, but it no longer defines me. And I'm not in pain about it because I've done so much work, and this is part of what I do. I help people remove the patterns, the self-sabotage, the conflict, and through energy. I do energy work with people as well as life coaching. And so it's no longer a definition of me. It's just part of me.
Now, you used a phrase there, of course, in this context. I understand what you mean by how you incorporate the molestation process or chapter of your life into who you are today. But there might be somebody sitting there going, oh, so you think it's a good idea. Maybe all children should be molested because then they can turn out like you. That's not what she said. I don't think that's what she's saying.
No, but that's a really good point to bring up, Richard. That's not the case at all. And recently there was a little girl, 5 years old in India, that was raped by a 22-year-old man.
I remember the story.
It's gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
And my heart goes out to all the people that have been molested, and there's millions of them. It is the single most difficult event for anybody to encounter, next to murder. Of course, murder means that, you know, you go on, you live another life, if you believe in reincarnation. But being molested, that's something that's with you forever. And if you don't deal with it, it will resurface in many other ways.
Mm. We're talking with Jennifer Elizabeth Masters. She has written a book called Odyssey, Victim to Victory. We're going to talk more about that as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I want you to stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Odyssey, not Homer's Odyssey. And if I had read Homer's Odyssey, I'd know the difference between that and this. Victim to Victory is the subtitle, and the author of this version of Odyssey is Jennifer Elizabeth Masters. And we're talking about her sojourn, if you will, through. And that'd be another question for you. Why not something a little more dramatic than Odyssey as a one-word description of what you have put between the covers of this book?
I went back and forth on the title of the book, but the fact that it is a journey, and that's what got me with the name Odyssey, that life is a compilation of events. It's not just one thing. So it is many things that happen. It's the many people that we come in contact with and all of our life experiences that come to make you who you are.
I know I hear people say from time to time that, if I could just go back and not do this or do that and so on and so forth. And I stop them and I say, hold on. If you go back and you pull the thread anywhere along the line in your life's path, you will no longer be the person you are today. You will change that person, which of course, as far as we know, we can't go back and do that, at least not yet anyway. But then you have to wonder, gee, you know, I'm in such a good place today. I am feeling so good about myself. Hey, you pull on that one thread, you don't know what you're going to be in that present moment, if you will. You know, the whole aspect of multiple timelines and all of that gets into a whole other genre of conversation that, you know, we could go down that road. But I think that's real important for us to, and maybe you can share with us a little bit about how you came from a place of regret and even the shame that comes along with the awakening within yourself, the awareness of what you went through as a child.
You know, Richard, I would like to speak to the subject of shame and guilt
okay. In
a broader sense, not just for people that have been abused or molested, but it will encompass all.
Mm-hmm.
One of my clients that I'm working with right now has been married 3 times, and one of the things that she has recently brought to my attention, and of course I knew that it was there because I experienced it myself, she's ashamed that she's been married 3 times. And when we have life events that cause us shame, it lowers our vibration. And coming to a place of seeing those events as just an experience instead of looking at it with judgment and a positive way, then it shifts it from being wrong to something that is just intricately a part of you. Now, Elizabeth Taylor didn't have shame about being married 7 times. Not at all. You know, she was a powerful goddess.
I think she kind of enjoyed it.
I do. I do too. But it was an issue with me when I came to the end of my fourth marriage and sat in front of my bank manager with 5 different IDs, including my maiden name. You know, there was initially guilt there. And it took me about 6 months to overcome it. And this is one of those things that women, when we get back into the dating scene, hiding something like that rather than dealing with it up front. Now, that's what some people do. Rather than tell somebody up front, I've been married 4 times or I've been married 5 times, they keep it hidden until the person becomes invested. And then they say, oh, by the way, I have to tell you, I've been married
mm-hmm.
5 times before this relationship. I personally feel it's much better to deal with things right up front. Be up front about it. Be honest with yourself about it. And instead of looking at it as a mistake, it's an experience. It's just another experience that taught you more about yourself.
Sometimes that can be quite a steep hill to climb for some because of the trauma, if you will, that they have experienced in their lives. And you said something else as well that I thought was interesting. And you've also been very clear as you've been sharing your story here that you have never made reference to any other individuals than yourself. And that you, in the context of our conversation, you have taken responsibility for the events that took place in your life, the molestation.
Well, when we're in that victim role, we're blaming others. And when you are blaming others, then the onus for your life is being put on someone else. It disempowers you. We want to be empowered. So looking at things from the perspective that I created this, whether it was through my choices before I was born or through my choices in my life, I've created this. And our thoughts, too, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
We create with our thoughts. So if you think you're a victim, you will be a victim. I choose not to be a victim. I am responsible. And I'm glad that you brought that up because that's a very powerful part of loving yourself is being responsible for all of your life instead of taking the power away from yourself and blaming others.
And you are also known as, or at least you have a website that refers to that concept, the self-love guru. I like that. I have never met, and I am glad I am meeting for the first time, a female guru. I think that's great. And also this whole aspect of victimhood. Now, It's interesting how I kind of observe going back to the 80s, 90s, and into the 21st century. I noticed that in the 80s, there was the whole victimhood thing. There was always, it's mom and dad's fault that I am this way because they didn't or they did do these things. In the 90s, it was interdependence. And there were, the books came out about codependency and so forth. And I'm just loving the way these labels almost fall away after a period of time, not because they don't apply, but because we're still dealing with the same stuff today, but we just give it a new name, you know? But it's all still the same stuff.
That's very true.
And so here we are in the 21st century, and I often ask myself, not so much as I did back in the 80s when I went through my own processes in group settings, when are they going to get it, realizing, oh, I'm in this room too, and I guess I'm part of the they now. But more in a broader sense, when are we collectively going to come to a place in our civilization, in our social structure and forward momentum, when we can stop doing these kinds of things to one another, to ourselves and each other, so that when we come into this world, we can start building. We can start contributing. We can start living our purpose and living up to our full potential, which will lead to some questions that I have for you at the end of the program. Tell me about your intuitive abilities. And I use that word just because it's less charged energetically. People seem to accept that word a little bit better. But I'm curious as to when you became in touch with that part of yourself. Was it even during your childhood, during these traumatic periods of molestation?
Yes. My life experience as a child made me look for other ways to be happy because I guess I was so fragmented. And my angels and guides would talk to me, and I called them my parents called them my imaginary friends, but they were very real. Mm-hmm. And they would talk to me and share things with me. And I believe that that's really what helped me get through so much of my childhood. At the age of 21, I heard God call my name, and I didn't realize it was God. I thought it was my father. But I was out in the middle of Canada. That's where I was from. My parents had a farm, and I was at the way back end of the property, and I heard my name called. When I ran down to the house, I thought my dad needed me. You know, my mother and he both stood there looking at me in disbelief. No, neither of them had called me. And so growing up, I guess when I was about 16, I knew I was going to live in the United States. I just had this inner knowing. And then as I got older and older, I had a landscape business. And when I was loading up my truck and my trailer, certain items I would need would be lit up, highlighted with this, aura or glow around them. And I learned that if I didn't take the particular tool that was highlighted, that would be the very thing that I would miss. And many people get guidance and they argue with the guidance they receive. And I did that for the longest time. But when I stopped arguing and started to trust the guidance, it's never wrong. It's always accurate. And you asked me about the abilities. I predicted the deaths of 6 people last year accurately, including my ex-husband. No, I had nothing to do with his death. He did ask me about it, though. He had had some dental issues, and said the dentist said the infection was gone, and I told him, no, it's moved into your heart, and if you keep doing the work you're doing, it's going to kill you. And that was in May 24th, and by July the 5th, he was dead.
Mm.
So
wow.
I'm also a medium, and animals, especially dogs, communicate with me. I would see them on the trails in Boulder, Colorado, and they'd come up to me and just kind of give me information about them, how old they were, something that they wanted me to pass on to their owner. So I really am tapped into the divine consciousness, and my information is very accurate.
Well, my and it sounds like something I'd like to pursue with you later, but my wife and I just acquired a new puppy back in February. His name is Angus. He is now a 17, 18-month-old King Black Shepherd. It's funny, too, because people will see him and say, oh, he's getting lighter. He's getting lighter. And as the weeks go on, and I'm videotaping this dog playing with my dog, Makushla, he's getting darker, folks. He's going to be a black dog, okay? And of course, we watch both of them. We're really trying to stay very much in tune with them and understand how they operate. And that's one of the things that I have made sort of abundantly clear to myself is that whatever these animals do, whether it be our cats or the dogs, it's what they do. It is not my job to get them to not do or to do things that I want them to do. Outside of, let's say, just the training. I take my dog for a walk with a special collar, and she is just – it's unbelievable, the transformation. But it's my job to try to figure out why they are doing the things that they do. Everything they do for a reason. And sometimes it's just because they love us. And that's how they show us, you know, through different things. Other times it's because we didn't do something for them that they needed, that kind of thing.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. And, for example, we've cordoned off a 15 or 20 foot by 8 or 10 foot area on our porch where he is secure and safe, but where if he makes a mess, guess what? He's been in that space for 6 or 8 hours, and if he makes a mess, it's okay. And you're familiar with some of these new products they have out where you can, you know, lay out these pads that attract them. There's this scent on them.
Right.
He uses it. He goes to it and he uses it. It's just absolutely amazing. It's almost like artificial diaper material kind of thing.
Hmm.
It's extraordinary. But again, he does what he does. And if he were to start tearing up the piece of furniture that's sitting in there, it's because he's bored. Because he is feeling that anxiety of separation. Even though we come back every day, he doesn't know that. Any more than my dog knows that we're coming back every afternoon. And that's why they go crazy and jumping around the way they do when we do come home, because they're just thrilled to see us and to see each other and so on and so forth. I'm curious as to, I mean, I feel, and this kind of goes to what you said too about listening to that still small voice. I wrote down something about 15, 20 years ago in a group setting where I said that I will listen to, and then in all caps, and follow the promptings. It's like you said, you know, grabbing that one tool. Okay, it's highlighted, and if I don't grab it, I'm going to need it. It doesn't do a whole lot of good just to listen if you don't follow the promptings.
Exactly.
So I feel like I'm doing that with these animals, and it feels pretty darn good. That doesn't mean that I don't get a little frustrated when he is in his crate whining. Usually there's a reason for that. Sometimes it's just, again, that separation anxiety. Sometimes it's because he has one of three things that he needs to do. But I find a lot of people, they don't even have that much consideration for their fellow human beings.
Or children.
They're not listening and tapping into.
Well, you know, listening, this is, I'll get on my soapbox here. Most of us as parents think our children are just children, and I've got to make this comment. When my daughter was 7, she was born awake. Now, what does that mean? She remembered her past lives. She remembered her other parents. She remembered her own children. She remembered her previous death. And when she was 7, she said to me, Mommy, you know, I know you look at me and you see a little girl, but inside my body is a grown-up soul.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
It changes everything.
Uh-huh. Now, the question I have is, is she now an adult?
She's 16, almost 17.
Does she still remember this? Is
Yes.
she still in touch with it?
She has prophetic dreams every single night.
How did you manage to allow her to hold on to that? Because our society wants to reprogram.
Well, I have another question. Why did she choose me? She chose me as a parent because she knew that I would allow her to be herself and not deprogram her.
Wow.
I have not had had her immunized. I've kept her away from doctors, medical field. I have been very protective of, you know, society to keep her in spiritual groups and try and, you know, allow her. She's traveled a great deal with me. So she's had a lot of experiences with adults in spiritual environments to expand her. So there's a lot of different things that she got because she chose me as a mother.
And she's aware of that fact in particular.
Yes, she is.
Wow. And she's now 16. Amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, I hear this story all the time as far as how we do come into this world aware of our previous existence and so forth. But unfortunately, things come along that cover that over. It's never erased, but it's covered over. There are other things that come along that are stronger, if you will, that this is what people don't understand about the digital age. Just because you overwrite something on your hard drive doesn't mean what was there two or three or four layers earlier is gone. It's
right.
Still there. It is possible to recover that.
Right.
So I'm curious, is there a way for, I'm 53 years old now, and I have no conscious awareness of, let alone my birth into this life, previous lives, let alone my previous existence outside of human existence. Are there ways that we can tap into that? Reconnect
Absolutely.
With that and become conscious of it?
Absolutely.
And they are?
Well, there is a breath that you can do that will help you access the time before birth, actual conception, and you can go back to that point and experience it in reverse.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the programs that I help people do. Having a practitioner to help you through it is really powerful because most people would stop because as issues start to come up and feelings start to come up, we are historically programmed as a society mm-hmm. to not experience and process emotions. And just the simple word emotion, it means emote, motion. It's energy in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you stuff your emotions, which society dictates that we do, that stuff is stuck in your cells and stuck in your body. And this type of breath work is a very good way to experience it, allow it to come up and out. A lot of tears, you know, weeping, gnashing of teeth, as I call it.
Yeah.
I help people process the experiences that they're going through.
This is quite extraordinary, and it makes me think of something that someone shared with me in a program I went through a few years back, where we men, and they were focusing specifically on men, but women, it's the same kind of thing, but not in a literal sense. But men in particular, when they are born into this world, obviously at their birth, and then they spend the rest of their lives trying to get back into the womb. Okay. And that actually goes into a program we would have to do late night, but nonetheless, it's the same. You understand the concept I'm talking about.
I do.
And it's something that, it's like when I heard that, I'm going, well, okay, there is some truth to that. I can certainly relate to and understand that. But it's really interesting for me, as a male in particular, as I go through my life and the relationships I've had over the years, both intimate and just, you know, platonic, and was very frustrated when I went through 4 weeks of therapy at the behest of my now ex-wife and her best friend. The therapist basically asked me, so could you give me a list of the names of your friends? And 99.9% of the names were female. To which she concluded there was something wrong with me. Now, I had male friends, but for whatever reason, they didn't come up in the conversation, and I was labeled as having, quote-unquote, character flaws. And it was at that point that I said, thank you very much, have a nice day, and I have never paid this woman, and this is going back 15, 20 years, I never paid this woman for those four sessions because I thought, are you kidding me? I know a therapist is not supposed to be a yes person. I get that. But they're also not supposed to criticize you, you know, and add more labels and more problems to the issues that you're there to get resolved.
Right.
And so I thought, no, this is not a therapist. I could have gone to my best friend and done this, and I wouldn't have had to worry about, you know, the financial aspect of it.
Well, with your best friend, you probably wouldn't have received so much judgment.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to go back to what we were talking about earlier in the program as far as same-sex and opposite-sex relationships and so forth. And my best friend who I went through, I met him in fifth grade, and we went through grade school, high school, and college together, stayed in touch, still try to stay in touch, and he's gone through some very rough times in the last few years. But back when we were in college, he revealed it to me that he was gay. And the only response that I could come up with at that moment was, and what do you want me to do with that information? Am I supposed to change how I look at you and how I view you? Although then there was the proverbial question that probably most people will ask of their same-sex friends who come out of the closet, as it is said, or come out. I said, have you ever been attracted to me? To which he said, no. And there was a part of me that was a little dejected.
I was just going to ask you if you were dejected.
I thought, oh man. Well, and I wasn't having much luck with the females either. Not that was going to deter me from to switch teams or anything of that nature, as the phrase goes. But it was like, so what? I mean, I'm glad that you finally come to the realization. Not that I ever knew. You know, it wasn't like, oh yeah, I always knew you were gay, but I wasn't going to say anything. It's like, you're still my friend. And we've still had the experiences that we've had over the course of time. It explains a few things that have happened over the years. Not that it changes anything. At least I understand better now why, oh, that's why he was that way. But I was just happy that he had finally found himself. And as you talk about this, the book Odyssey, and how you want this to bring about, you know, a greater connectedness in relationships, no matter what the level, I'm curious as to how your relationships are today in that regard, and have you been able to get to a place now where you can actually consider that possibility of a long-term committed, I'm not going anywhere, I've worked through my issues relationship with another man?
Absolutely. And actually, I'm in so much different place than I've been, you know, the rest of my life, where I see myself very differently. And I know and love my flaws. I know what they are. I recognize what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And actually, I'm dating. And so that's why, you know, I mentioned about mentioning the four marriages right off the top.
Uh-huh.
You might as well get the worst of it out of the way
and
then either move on or move forward. So yes, I absolutely am, you know, pursuing a long-term relationship. I don't know that marriage is something I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I may or may not. A piece of paper to me, you know, is inconsequential to the relationship.
Well, I would agree. The only thing I've been able to research, that piece of paper, and actually it doesn't really give you even an economic boost up, because whether you file your taxes as a separate individual or jointly, whether you file with separate incomes or you combine them, it's still the same. It all works out mathematically the same, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no economic benefit.
Well, now, if I was going to have children. I just choked. I have children,
mm-hmm.
but I, you know, I'm not going to have any more. But
right.
For people that are having children,
right.
I think and feel that marriage is a very important part of family.
Right.
You know, very important.
And I know that in this country, the issue of same-sex marriages is hot on the table. I just put out this one question to individuals in same-sex relationships and or marriages in that regard who are opposed to same-sex marriages. How is that same-sex marriage interfering with or influencing your relationship?
Interesting, yes.
It's like if that's, I mean, what are they? Are they coming over to your house to try to convert you? I don't think so.
Well, I have a thought about that.
Please.
It has two points. One, I don't care, and it is none of my business what somebody else thinks of me.
Mm-hmm.
It's none of my business. And so it is none of my business how someone else runs their life or lives their life. It's none of my business. So why would you want to impose or project your thoughts, morals, or judgment on another?
Yeah.
Only God can do that.
It is an extraordinary world in which we live where people apparently think that that is important to do. I'm remiss in not looking up the lyrics to this song so that I know the title of the song because I use the line quite often. But I have enough trouble running my own life. I'll be damned if I'll run his. Something along those lines.
Yes, that's a really good. I remember that song. I can't think of what it is.
Yeah.
But the other point about that is that when you're focusing on somebody else, you're not focusing on yourself. So people do that, especially when they're having personal pain and they want to take the attention, the pressure, you know, sort of remove some of the suffering and focus on someone else instead. And really, it's not wise. We need to focus on ourselves, even within a relationship. The focus should always be on you. How you conduct your life instead of pointing the finger at the other person.
It's interesting that you should say that. My perspective has been in the 33 plus years that I have been in this industry and worked for various radio stations that when I get asked the question, well, what do you think about what this station's doing or that station or the other station? I says, I don't care. I said, my job is to make the station that I am working at better today than it was yesterday. That's my job. Now, if the general manager or the program director, assuming I'm not he, wants to listen to and follow the other stations and counter program to that, that's their business. But as a producer, it's my job to make the station I'm at sound the very best that it can. And hopefully tomorrow I'll make it sound even better. And it's kind of like that phrase, that a house divided against itself. Will not stand. Well,
right.
When you divide your attentions, how are you going to achieve? And of course, you're expending energy in both directions. You know, it's like multitasking. They're saying, I don't know if you saw the study that came out a few months back that talked about the level of productivity of those people who multitask. Yeah, they're multitasking and they're doing a lot of things at the same time, but the quality of the productivity suffers. I thought that was an interesting study that had come out. And so when we do that in our relationships the same way, that's what happens.
Well, there's an energetic phrase. Wherever you focus your attention or energy, it expands. Wherever you put your focus or energy, that will expand. So when you take your energy away from something, the thing or relationship that you're taking your energy away from will suffer and decrease.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, my guest is the author of Odyssey, Victim to Victory, Jennifer Elizabeth Masters. And we've been talking a great deal about a lot of different things here, but they're all relevant and apply to what you have written in your book. And people can find out more by going to you have to have a website.
I do.
And that is?
JenniferElizabethMasters.com.
Ah, so simple.
You can also get to my website through theselfloveguru.com.
I like that. Selfloveguru.com is the website, and we encourage people to do that. We are linked to your website. I think that one of the things that I find so interesting about when people do write books is they will then put at the back of their book a lot of neat information, appendices and so forth, but then you have additional reading that you suggest to folks. And I think that's really really neat. If the Buddha, this is an intriguing title, If the Buddha Married. Okay, well, who you never know. If the Buddha died, no, dated, I beg your pardon, If the Buddha Dated. Interesting, interesting.
That's a really good book for people that are venturing into the dating scene.
And you also have resources in here as well, places where people can go to get additional help and support, as well as to touch base with you. And they can reach you, again, as we said, through selfloveguru.com, email address where if they wanted to get in touch with you and set
Certainly.
Up some type of an appointment.
Divine, that's D-I-V-I-N-E, healingnow@yahoo.com. But they could also reach me through my website, and the easier way may be jenniferelizabethmasters.com. There's a contact form, and I read every email that comes across my desk. So if you want to contact me for a private session or just to talk with me to see if there's a good fit, you could do so.
Let me ask you before we wrap up the program, your thoughts about this invention, if you will, that's out there called social media, and your observations on whether it is a detriment or a benefit to the kinds of relationships that you are talking about us fostering.
Well, there's, you know, there's positives and negatives. It expands your reach around the world. You can talk to people in all sorts of different countries. However, typically you're not going to have a heart connection with those people. And that's what life is all about, heart connections, people reaching other people on a heart level. And that's what's much more beneficial. I feel that the Twitter, the Facebook, and all these little bleeps and messages, it's a further disconnection from yourself, a distraction, like phone and cell phone, television. All of those things are a distraction.
I would tend to agree with you, and it's that's why I always love having my guests in studio whenever possible. And that's why I always offer the invitation, as I do now to you, that if you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, love to have you in studio to talk face-to-face about a lot of this and continue the conversation.
Well, I'll bring my bathing suit when I do come, Richard.
There you go. Well, we got lots of beach. Lots of beach, so you'll be able to do so.
I would love that.
That would be great. Before we close our program, three questions that I pose to my guests. Number one. Who is Jennifer Elizabeth Masters?
She is a loving, compassionate teacher and healer.
Number two, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Helping others come to a place of self-love and understanding, so that they can have healthier relationships and deeper connections.
By the way, to that end, I've often used the metaphor, if you will, that if God had intended for each one of us to live silent, solitary lives, there are certainly enough, I'll call them Class M planets, in the universe that each one of us, each 7 billion of us, each individual would have their own planet. However, my observation is that that is not the case because guess what? We're all here.
It's all about our relationships. When I've seen a lot of people die in the last year, and the thing that I've learned about death is that it's not about what you had, the amount of money you had. It is about who you are and the way you related to others.
You know, I have to wonder, too, I don't know if you've seen, it's an older movie about the afterlife with Foster Brooks, not Foster Brooks, with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep. and they're doing a review of their lives. And I have to wonder if maybe if it's possible, if it were possible, to scan the memories of those still living. And your life would be successful the more people who remembered you. You know what I mean?
That's very accurate.
Oh, really?
Very accurate. Absolutely. But there is, though, the negative aspect that people remember Hitler, but not for good things.
Well, that's true. There is that negative downside. And finally, how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, as Jesus said, this you can do and more. We all have the ability to create, to co-create, to manifest. We have the ability to live life fully. We also have the ability to bring death upon ourselves. So we're very powerful.
And by the way, I've been looking, staring at the cover of your book. I'm not going to say. Most people will probably be able to see it right away. It took me a few minutes to figure out what that image is on the cover of your book. And I'm not going to tell them what it is, but I'm going to encourage you to go to her website, which is selfloveguru.com. Check out the information. Check out the book, Odyssey, Victim to Victory. Jennifer Elizabeth Masters, thank you so much for joining us on the program and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Richard. It was a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. You've been listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time, love to all.